It's The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD from Slate, in for Tanzina Vega this week. With around 32% of the population in the U.S. fully vaccinated and 44% partially vaccinated, demand for the COVID-19 vaccine has begun to wane. But there's a huge chunk of the population for which no vaccine has been approved, at least not yet, and that's children. Currently, in the U.S., anyone over the age of 16 is eligible to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has been approved for use in people as young as 16, while both the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines are approved for ages 18 and up. But what about the youngest people among us?
Although kids are at low risk of severe COVID-19, they are not at no risk.
That is
Dr. Zinaida Good, and I'm a research fellow at Stanford University. We have two kids, Andal and Soren. Soren is just 8 months, and Andal is 3 years old. We love them very much.
Thousands of children, some as young as 6 months, are currently participating in vaccine trials. Dr. Good's two children are participating in the phase one trial of the Pfizer vaccine at Stanford.
This is an open label trial where you know what you get, where all kids get a vaccine at 1/10, 1/3, 2/3, or a full adult dose. Both kids did great after the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine and had no notable side effects. My 3-year-old will have the second vaccine tomorrow, and the baby will get the second one next week. It will likely prevent them from spreading the virus, as fully vaccinated adults spread the disease about 90% less, according to a recent study by CDC.
Last night, the Associated Press reported that the FDA is expected to grant fast-track approval to Pfizer for kids aged 12 and up in the next week. For more on these trials and when we can expect to see vaccines more widely available for younger Americans, I'm joined by Dr. Miriam Laufer, pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine Center for Vaccine Development and Global Health. Dr. Laufer, thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So the FDA is soon likely going to authorize the Pfizer vaccine for kids ages 12 to 15. How significant will that authorization be?
It's a very good question. This is a much awaited authorization for those of us with school-age children who are trying very hard to get back to some sort of regular school life. The truth is this will increase the availability of vaccines for a small segment of the population, right, about a 4-year age range. I think it's important for a number of reasons. One, it will show further confidence in the safety and efficacy of these vaccines. What we see in this pandemic is there is just a limit to how much our behavioral interventions have been able to stop the spread of COVID-19. And it's really with widespread vaccination that we'll be able to get rid of at least the pandemic nature of this infection and allow us to return to regular life. Certainly, school-aged children, or at least in this age group, are a population that don't have a huge burden of severe disease and death. But we do know that they have a lot of infections. They're certainly responsible for transmission of COVID-19 to their older adult family members. In addition, I think this could represent a great opportunity for schools to reopen with more confidence and being able to resume activities that seem to be much more, you know, a normal part of school life.
Do you think that most states are going to be able to make this available to kids who are 12 and up, or is the supply not there yet?
That's a great question. If you had asked me this a few months ago, I would have said states will not open up vaccine to children under 16 years of age because they'll be too busy vaccinating adults. What we're seeing now is that there is adequate supply, and we've created these massive infrastructure systems to vaccinate huge numbers of people, stadiums, convention centers. And so given the ability to vaccinate large numbers of people and the unfortunate case where the supply is adequate, if not exceeding the demand, I do think it will be, let's just say, an easy lift for states to expand the age range of people that are available for vaccination. That's my guess at this point.
You know, schools obviously require proof of vaccination in most cases for kids to come to school for a whole bunch of different diseases. Do you expect that there will be a similar requirement for these more novel vaccines?
I have two opinions. There's two ways of looking at this. One is that we're in extraordinary times with a pandemic that is essentially raging out of control, with one intervention that we think will be the key to getting it under control and to safe reopening of our regular life, and that's vaccination. And if you look at it that way, I do think schools will require vaccination in order for children to come back to school, you know, the 12 years old and up. Just like other vaccines, there will be ways to get exemptions from that requirement. So I suspect there, assuming the ACIP that makes the recommendation for vaccines does recommend the vaccine for this age group, that it will be, if not either encouraged or a requirement. We're seeing this in universities as more and more universities are requiring vaccination for students and faculty to come back onto campus. On the other hand, this is not yet a fully FDA-approved vaccine, and so there is some, it's not in the same category as, for example, our measles vaccine, which has already gone through the complete review process. The COVID-19 vaccines are under emergency use authorization, so they had a very thorough but more sped-up review because of the emergency need of the vaccination.
What about younger kids? I know there are trials underway right now. What do you think the timeline is for children who are under the age of 12?
So we have a few different trials that are going on now. One is to include other vaccines that would want to expand their age group. So the Novavax vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, both are looking to expand their age group to the 12 and up age group. In addition, there are now vaccination trials for the under 12-year-old group. There's a few, you know, the way that we safely do vaccine trials in children is always what we call age de-escalation, right? So we start with the teenagers and then we move down because presumably as children get younger, they're more susceptible to adverse events. And then the other thing we'd need to find out is what the correct dose is of the vaccine. So, you know, obviously a 15-pound one-year-old will not require the same dose as a 160-pound adult. So we use the lowest possible dose we can think of and then increase as we need to see how much of the dose is needed to get a good immune response and to make sure it's safe in that population. Because there's a lot less disease in younger children, instead of having an endpoint of COVID illness, which has been the endpoint for our adult trials, it was looked at in these adolescent trials. The endpoint for the vaccine trials will be just looking at the antibody response, how well your body responds to the vaccine and makes antibodies to fight the virus. That makes it a little bit easier because we don't have to wait and see if anybody gets COVID-19 illness. On the other hand, we're very careful with these pediatric vaccines and the march down from, let's say, the 10 and 11-year-olds getting us all the way down to the 6-month-old will take some time because we're monitoring the safety so carefully.
You know, I'm thinking about vaccine hesitancy and parents and children. My mom was a polio pioneer. She marched into her second grade classroom and got the shot, and her parents were completely fine with that. We are obviously in a very different scenario now. Do you expect that we may see some vaccine hesitancy among parents of younger kids, even parents who are completely fine for their children to get kind of the standard battery of vaccines?
I think it's possible. You know, we're in a time that is just generally, I think, panicked about public health. And while some of us respond to that by saying we're going to do everything we can to stem this pandemic, I think there's just a lot of concern and worry that maybe we're wrong. And So I think there's that level of concern. I do want to just reemphasize that these vaccine trials, although done amazingly quickly, were done with exactly the same rigor as all other vaccine trials for FDA-approved vaccines. So yeah. I do feel that the science does support the fact that the vaccines work extraordinarily well and that they are safe.
Given that children have generally seen kind of less severe disease, and we are thinking about kind of the global burden of vaccine, does it make sense to be vaccinating, you know, otherwise quite healthy preteens and teens when there is a real crisis in other parts of the world and, you know, vaccine rates of 2% and 3% in countries where there are a lot of vulnerable adults?
I think that's, you know, if I said it was a $100 million question, that wouldn't even be enough to capture it. So there's two elements to that question. One is, should we be vaccinating, in this country, younger children? And it's true that they are less likely to have severe disease or die from COVID-19 infection. There is this phenomenon of multi-organ system failure in children as a result of COVID-19. But they don't see nearly as much severe disease and death as older adults do. So then why should we vaccinate them? And the answer is for us to stop COVID-19 transmission, to make it so that COVID-19 is no longer spreading rapidly in this country, we will need to have everybody vaccinated and not have anybody carrying the infection, even if they're well. In fact, the people who carry infection when they're well are, we don't know how effectively they spread COVID-19, but we know that they are spreading COVID-19 because they're not sick, and so they're not staying home and they're going out and out there in the community.
Dr. Miriam Laufer is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Dr. Laufer, thank you so much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And now it's your turn to weigh in.
This is Susanna in Aiken, South Carolina, and I'm planning to get my kids vaccinated because they want to go to camp this summer, and I'll feel a lot better about sending them if they're vaccinated.
Hi, my name is Heidi Williams, and I live in Hillsboro, Oregon. I will absolutely be getting my two children vaccinated as soon as it's available to us because I believe in science. Our children have always been vaccinated. I see no reason why we should not continue. There's, you know, really no controversy around the vaccine except for things that have been drum up with, you know, politics in mind. Let's send our kids out there with every opportunity they have. And I think the opportunity to resist a deadly virus is a no-brainer.
This is Lou from Northern Wisconsin. As a former medical professional, I believe in science, and I will wait until proper time that would have been given for a proper trial for these vaccinations. And I'm kind of surprised at the medical professionals who are going ahead and getting the vaccines. I understand the fear behind it, but I also respect the science behind a proper trial.
James calling from Dover, Ohio. Would I get my children vaccinated for COVID-19? Absolutely not. I don't want my children being test subjects for a vaccine that we do not know the long-term effects of. Also, one of my children have already had a mild case of COVID-19, and it didn't seem to affect her very much. Getting a vaccine that we know little about is not worth the risk of them actually getting COVID-19.
This is Ryan from Ogden, Utah, and we will be getting our children vaccinated as soon as possible, except for our 11-year-old daughter who has type 1 diabetes. We will wait just a little longer to get her vaccinated just to see if there are any potential side effects.
Hi, this is David from Cleveland Heights, Ohio. I am calling about getting my child vaccinated. She's 10 years old, and I am very much looking forward to opportunities to get her vaccinated. And she is too, because she wants to be protected enough and be able to protect the rest of the family who are vaccinated. and she plays with other kids who are also not vaccinated, some of whose parents are not vaccinated. I have not been able to find a way to get her vaccinated yet. I hope to have that opportunity soon.
Hi, this is Carol. I'm in Vancouver, Washington. My answer is yes. I'm looking forward to getting both my 9 and 13-year-old vaccinated when they are eligible for a safe and reliable vaccine option. Until then, they are still remote learning and not participating in team sports.
For us, it's the grandchildren that need vaccination. The 17-year-old got vaccinated on the first day of availability, and we're anxiously awaiting the emergency use authorization for 12 to 15-year-olds. Why is it taking the FDA so long? This is Pat from San Jose.
Thank you so much for the honesty. We appreciate you being a part of our show every day. If you want to talk with us, remember, you can call us at 877-869-8252. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE, or record a voice memo and email it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. In the earlier days of social distancing, we heard about herd immunity as a means to ending the pandemic, that reaching a certain threshold of the population gaining immunity through vaccinations or natural infections, that the coronavirus runs out of people to spread to and things can go back to the way they were. But recent reporting from the New York Times found that experts think herd immunity in the U.S. is unlikely. Slipping vaccination rates combined with new variants and vaccine hesitancy makes it less likely we'll reach herd immunity anytime soon. Joining me now to discuss her reporting on the subject is Apoorva Mondavilli, a science reporter at the New York Times. Hi, Apoorva.
Hi.
Apoorva, in the early sort of moments and months of the pandemic, we talked about herd immunity as this concept as like the best way to beat the pandemic. How has that changed?
You're right, Lizzie. We did all talk about herd immunity as the goal. And that's because that's how it's worked for a lot of other infectious diseases. For example, for measles, you vaccinate enough people, you get to a point where enough people are protected from the virus that the virus no longer gets around as easily. What's changed now is that the two big things have happened. One is that around December, new variants started to come up of the virus that are more contagious. And herd immunity is based on a measure of contagiousness. And so with more contagious virus, the percent of the population that needs to be protected goes up. It was estimated to be 60 or 70% last year. Now the number is 80 or more. And second thing that happened is that, as you know, there is a substantial proportion of the population in the United States that is really hesitant, does not want to get the vaccine, may not get the vaccine. And so those two things have led scientists to conclude that herd immunity is extremely unlikely.
Yeah, you reported that in the New York Times, and it was a story that landed with kind of a splash. Should we interpret that as a sort of disappointing sign, or is it just that we should have a different goal?
Yeah, I wouldn't interpret this as a disappointing. I think it's just a different way of looking at it. And really what we need to do has not changed at all. What we still need to do is vaccinate as many people as possible so that we really bring down the number of hospitalizations and deaths. And that has not changed. What has changed is that we probably will not be completely rid of this virus when we get to this herd immunity threshold, which is what we had been hoping for. We will probably see outbreaks of the virus for many years to come. How big those outbreaks are will really depend on how close we get to herd immunity, what percent of the population we can vaccinate.
Yeah, I guess I think about this in two ways, the public health messaging part of it, and then kind of how we as a society deal with kind of whatever happens next. I wonder if people are going to receive this message and think, wait a minute, they're moving the goalposts on me again.
There's a real danger of that. And when I spoke to Dr. Fauci, he was worried about that as well, because you know, that's happened to him a few times now, that people accuse him of moving the goalposts. But I don't think that's what's happening here. I think the goalposts have moved themselves because of the biological behavior of the virus and because of the behavior of the human beings in this country. And it's not the experts. This is just what has happened because of those two big factors.
So what do you think that means we're left with in terms of managing the virus over the next months or years?
We have to keep our eye on the prize. The prize is bringing the numbers of hospitalizations and deaths down, easing the pressure on the healthcare system, and getting to a point where the majority of people who are getting infected are young and healthy so that they're not having severe infections. We want to protect as many of the high-risk people, the elderly and the people with other conditions that put them at risk as we can, so that really the infections that we do see are as mild as they could be.
So just over 30% of the U.S. population has been fully vaccinated. It's a larger number for having had one shot. Talk to me about kind of how quickly vaccine penetration and distribution means for the ability to achieve something resembling herd immunity, or I don't know, what kind of a vaccine percentage you'd like to see?
I think we would need to see 70 to 80% to really start to see herd immunity, but we could probably see effects closer to just 50%. That's sort of what's been happening in Israel. And we also reported yesterday, my colleagues and I, that the FDA is expected to authorize the vaccine for adolescents, 12 to 15-year-olds. Yeah, and then the vaccines for younger kids than that is not going to be that far behind. So even if there are a bunch of adults who are unwilling to get the vaccine, if we can vaccinate as many of those kids as we can, we might still get pretty close to herd immunity, you know, 60%, let's say, without actually having to crack every single adult into getting the vaccine.
I think one thing that people are trying to understand now is how the U.S. fits into this broader picture. So should we still be sort of aggressively pursuing these vaccination and, you know, immunity goals in the U.S. if the virus is still spreading so quickly in other places? And how do those things fit together?
So there are a couple of different complicated issues there. One is we do want to be vaccinated as a country. You know, we do want to protect as many of our citizens as possible. But at the same time, you know, I'm originally from India, and, you know, Brazil and India are having these enormous, enormous epidemics with just so many infections. So there's an ethical issue there as well of, do we want to be vaccinating our kids who are not really at high risk when there are high risk adults dying by the thousands in other countries? So that's a very difficult question to answer for a lot of people, because, you know, I can see just from responses to social media when this has come up that people are very divided. There's one side that, you know, adamantly believes that this is unethical, that we really should be giving away these doses to the countries who really need them. And then the other side says, let's take care of ourselves first before we start to take care of others. And there is an argument to be made for that as well, because as the infections keep raging on in other parts of the world, we might see more variants. And some of those variants are going to be more contagious. Some of them are going to evade the immune system. And so we do want to protect our citizens from those threats as well. So it's not really an easy or simple answer.
Apoorva Mondavilli is a science reporter at The New York Times. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in this week for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Last year, Colorado experienced the three largest wildfires in the state's history, all in one fire season.
The entire sky was red, and there was ash falling on every bit of the ground for about 4 or 5 days. And my vehicle was completely covered in ash. My house was completely covered in ash.
You can't really go anywhere, and now, you know, but you can't go home.
It's going to be a long haul from there. We're just going to put our heads down and we're all going to get through this together. And unfortunately, this is Grand County's little 9/11.
And now, Colorado Governor Jared Polis is already warning people to prepare for the upcoming fire season in order to avoid a similar catastrophe this year.
If you live in the wildland interface, surrounded by beautiful but highly flammable vegetation, it's about wildfire impact on your home. And it's not just an if, it's really about when. Planning ahead and taking actions to reduce the risk of wildfires can increase the likelihood that your home survives when wildfires occur.
Other lawmakers are also trying to find solutions to the state's fire crisis. Representative Neguse from Boulder, along with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, are pushing for the creation of a civilian climate corps to help manage natural ecosystems, including forest fires. And President Biden allocated $10 billion to the program in his recent infrastructure bill, the American Jobs Plan. Joining us today to talk about whether or not the Civilian Climate Corps might be able to mitigate these disastrous fires is ecologist and freelance writer Sarah LaMagna. Sarah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks.
And also with us is Mike Lester, director of the Colorado State Forest Service. Mike, thanks so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Sarah, before we get into the specifics of Colorado, can you describe what the Civilian Climate Corps proposal is?
Sure. So the idea of the Civilian Climate Corps is actually deeply rooted in our nation's history. So back in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt created what's called the Civilian Conservation Corps through the New Deal to get us out of the Great Depression. This Civilian Climate Corps is very much along the same lines, where the version is going to bolster wildfire prevention and preparedness to protect the health and safety of communities that are on the front lines of climate change. And that vision is in this new American Jobs Plan that's been put up by President Biden, allotting that $10 billion that you just said for this new generation of Americans to work to conserve these public lands and get people back to work.
When we think about how this might work on public lands, Mike, give me a sense of what it was like to live through those fires in Colorado last season.
Well, it was pretty interesting. We burned over 600,000 acres and all along the Front Range, constant rain of ash, curtailed outdoor activities, cut off a lot of our forests in Colorado to recreational pursuits, and engaged a lot of wildland firefighters. So it was a pretty tough summer, and we're not so sure we're not going to see a summer like that again this year.
How do things look now?
Well, right now we have above average temperatures projected and below average moisture, so it's not looking good. But of course, you know, wildland fires, there's a lot of elements to it. And of course you have heat, you've got wind, and you've got, those can be very variable. You can have a fire blowing, the wind blows the right direction and it'll put itself out. Other cases, it'll take a long run. We have one of the longest runs we've ever seen in Colorado history this summer with East Troublesome Fire, 100,000 acres in 24 hours. So it's those variables can dramatically change the way the fire develops.
Sarah, when you listen to Mike describe last year's fire season, what role could a civilian climate corps play in mitigating that kind of devastating damage?
Yeah, it can actually do quite a bit. So with that $10 billion, the Civilian Climate Corps can actually work on the front lines to help mitigate wildfires. So actually being in those communities directly affected by wildfire, helping with forest thinning, helping with actual wildfire prevention, putting out fires, it can really do a lot of good work. And then all of the effects of wildfire afterwards, so helping with watershed protection, those sorts of aspects, this CCC can do a huge, huge deal with it.
Mike, when you hear proposals like this, is it something that makes you excited about being able to maybe incorporate those people into what you do?
Well, it does. I think one of the issues we have is capacity. We have a capacity issue on logging crews. We have wood utilization. It's one of the reasons it's so expensive to do this work in Colorado. Mm-hmm. Landowners have to pay to have this work done. It's more of a service than providing a product like it does in the southern U.S. or the eastern U.S. So this capacity addition could be pretty helpful. Of course, there's a lot of training involved as well.
Yeah. Sarah, $10 billion is kind of the amount that's been put out there. But the Forest Service has estimated it would take about $4 billion in Colorado alone just to deal with the most pressing forestry issues. Is $10 billion enough?
I think everyone would argue no. But the point is that it's a huge step in the right direction. And so, like Mike had said, you need boots on the ground. You need training. This, you know, first off of $10 billion is just a start in the whole process. And Mike would argue too that this is something that needs to continually happen. Forest management is an every year thing. It can't just be this one off in an act. It has to be continual. But this is the first time that we're seeing sort of this aggressive tactic to really address climate change and wildfire mitigation since, you know, the 1930s. So it's definitely a huge step in the right direction.
You mentioned the 1930s, and Mike, one of the ironies here is that some of what the sort of WPA programs did and what the Roosevelt era programs did ended up making wildfire management harder and making wildfires worse. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. I think early on, back in 1910, when we had the big fires then, the idea was we need to get these fires quickly, put them out. I think the 10 o'clock rule is what they called it. We want those fires out by 10 o'clock the next morning. Hmm. And it seemed like a good idea at the time, but what it's done is left our forest overcrowded. And so we do have some issues with too much volume of wood. These forests are not in the condition they evolved to be in. For example, Ponderosa Pine in the Front Range evolved to be in frequent fire and park-like stands, and that's not what they look like today.
Sarah, where does all of this stand legislatively? And what would happen if, say, the plan doesn't move forward in Congress?
Sure, yeah. So currently, this is in President Biden's American Jobs Plan, which has not been passed by Congress. Currently, there are a few bills introduced in Congress basically to lay out the purposes of the Civilian Climate Corps and instructing both the Secretaries of Interior and the Secretary of Agriculture, who oversee the largest swaths of public land, to establish this Civilian Climate Corps. And there's another one that basically states to establish it through already current programs within the federal government, like AmeriCorps, which currently employs more than 75,000 Americans every year. But this would be slightly different, and it's laid out sort of in that bill what it would mean. But it's all basically conjecture at this point of anyone's guess on how things will be kind of split up between all of the states and whatnot. It's just currently up in the air at the moment.
Mike, when you think about sort of the years and maybe decades ahead, we know that climate change contributes to extreme weather events. And I wonder, on the ground in Colorado, if there is a sense that the tools you are fighting with are not enough right now, or a recognition that more needs to happen? Or am I getting that wrong?
No, I think you've got it essentially correct. We're seeing more tools this year, this legislative session. I kind of expected us to have a retrenchment, but it's been the reverse. The General Assembly and the Governor's Office have put considerable resources in with state money going for it. And when I say considerable, considerable compared to where we've been in the past. We've got a long way to go. I know Senator Bennett also has a bill out there to deal with forest conditions in the West. So we think this attention is really positive, but of course it has to end in action because we have a lot of work to do. And I think it was pretty well said earlier, this can't be sporadic. You know, this is like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. When you're done, you start all over again. And that's going to require consistent funding.
Do either of you have faith that this could be bipartisan?
I definitely do. Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like that is a hopeful thing to hear because climate has been so controversial. But I guess maybe, you know, the spate of terrible headlines that we've seen and the lived experiences of people in Colorado, Mike, have shown, you know, that this comes for everyone, no matter what you believe.
Well, they are America's forest.
All right. Thank you to both Sarah LaMagna, ecologist and freelance writer, and Mike Lester, director of the Colorado State Forest Service. I appreciate both of you joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The new Netflix series Shadow and Bone follows an orphan teen named Alina Starkov, who suddenly discovers extraordinary powers that could change the face of her war-ravaged world. Like a lot of big-budget fantasy shows and movies, think Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings, Shadow and Bone immerses its audience in its fictional world, complete with new lands, new people, new creatures, and new languages.
Where did you learn how to speak Yeri like a native?
I speak six languages.
Fjerdin, which I don't speak, is just one of the fictional languages created specifically for Shadow and Bone, which is based on Leigh Bardugo's best-selling young adult fantasy novels. And when places like HBO or Marvel need somebody to do that, construct a language from scratch, they often turn to this guy.
My name is David J. Peterson. I'm a language creator, and I've created over 50 languages for television shows and films in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right. David has created a lot of languages.
Dothraki. High Valyrian.
Zadrizes Buzdaris Gosdaur.
Irathian. Castathan. Kinukaz. Sondi. Noleth. Shivaisa. Wozvochen. Uvisi. Fjerdin. Ravkin.
Before creating languages professionally, David had been creating them on his own for fun for a decade. If I were to ask you to say hello in Dothraki, what would that be?
Dothraki, you'd say Batsumaruon.
All right.
I started in 2000 when I was a sophomore at UC Berkeley. I just kind of happened upon it. And I hooked up with other language creators online and started to really learn the craft. And really, I just did it recreationally. And I expected that that would be the case, that I would only do it recreationally, you know, for the rest of my life. And I enjoyed it well enough, so that was fine for me. In 2009, the entire language creation community got an unexpected opportunity. The producers of Game of Thrones emailed the Language Creation Society out of the blue with no forewarning and asked if they could help create the Dothraki language. And so what happened was the Language Creation Society put together a competition. They announced it to language creators everywhere. I applied with many others, and I was the one who made it through the gauntlet.
When you're doing something like this for Game of Thrones, for Shadow and Bone, are you a linguist? Are you a creator? Like, how are you thinking about the structure of language? Are you operating just carte blanche in your head, or are you trying to adhere to some rules that you know from existing languages?
In terms of how it feels, you know, before I created languages, all I did was write fiction. And for me, the feeling is very similar. So it feels like you're just creating, like you're an artist. However, everything that I do is informed by, I mean, you know, I have a bachelor's and master's in linguistics. It's informed by what I know about language. Because what you're trying to do, especially when you're creating a more or less realistic language, like I did for Game of Thrones, and like I did with Christian Talman to create the Fjordan language for Shadow and Bone, is you're trying to create something that is plausibly human. Because the people that you're creating these languages for, it may be in a fantasy setting, but they're real human beings. And so we try to create something that fits the setting, that's fun, that we enjoy, that's interesting, but that adheres to what we know about human languages.
Are there pitfalls to think about when you're doing this? I mean, I would imagine that you must think about not falling into racial or ethnic stereotypes, for example, or thinking about, I don't know, sounding like Western languages or non-Western languages. Like, how do you think through that part?
I think one of the key issues is that a lot of stereotypes about language have to do with sound, and they have really no basis in fact. There's this characteristic that a language that has a sound like "kh" is a harsh language, which is really bizarre, because then if you ask people, well, what are harsh languages to your ear? And they say things like, oh, like German and Dutch and Russian and Arabic. But what they don't realize when they say that is that this sound like "kh", for example, it's found in both Spanish and French. But nobody describes those languages as harsh. And you begin to wonder why, and you realize, well, it's not actually the sound of it. It's something else going on. It's something that goes back to cultural and racial stereotyping. So when a language creator sits down to create a language, it helps to understand all the choices that you're making from the top down. Knowing that, first of all, that there is no connection between the sound of a language and the people who speak it. There's also no connection between the grammar of a language and the people who speak it. The connection that you see between culture and language, it comes through in the actual words that are there, both in the words that exist in the language, and that you're more likely to have a native term for things that exist in your life, and borrowed terms for things that you have borrowed. But also, culture peeks through in idioms and expressions and things like that. And there, you know, it makes sense to laser focus on the people you're creating the language for. Don't think that, you know, oh, these people are like, you know, X group or people who speak Y language in the real world. Forget that. Just think, here are these fictional people, and I'm going to use them as my inspiration solely, and I'm not going to think about anything else. Rather than thinking about other languages and being informed by them, just focus on linguistic science, what makes sense, you know, what is plausible for a human language, and make those decisions for the language itself. But as long as you adhere to creating a unique vision, then you're going to end up with a unique language, and that's really the goal.
Why do you think that there's this interest or demand for this kind of sort of escape into another world right now? You know, why are you in such demand?
It's the same reason we like to travel. It's fun to see what life is like somewhere else. And, you know, when you go to a different country, it's such a huge sensory experience. When you're watching a TV show or a movie, you get a fraction of that. Like, you're not going to know what it smells like, what the air feels like. And so you have to work with the visuals and the audio. And I think what happened with not even Game of Thrones, I think before that, I think what happened with the Lord of the Rings movies is that when they used Tolkien's languages, it really helped you feel like this is somewhere that's totally different for two reasons. One, it's a language that, you know, doesn't sound like any other, which is achievable even with gibberish. But something that's unique about language that has structure, is that your brain can pick up on these repeated patterns, these intonational patterns that make something sound like a language as opposed to sounding like gibberish. Where gibberish is just random, language has patterns. And even if you can't understand the language, your brain can pick up on that. And so it makes a big difference when there's an authentically created language and it's used in the production to help flesh out that world. It makes it feel real. It makes it feel like being in another country. And so it just helps up the level of the realism of a show.
You know, you mentioned The Lord of the Rings, and I'm thinking, okay, Elvish was in the books. Do you think there's something different about now, today, that has led to work like yours becoming more popular and more widespread?
It might sound like a simple explanation, but I think it's really true. I think it had to do with the popularity of Game of Thrones. Because if you look back at the, you know, constructed languages in TV and film. First, the first one was actually in Land of the Lost, which was a kid's show. Nobody was going to pay attention to that. But after that, it was like Klingon was created for the Star Trek movie. You have Lord of the Rings, which is a movie. You have Avatar, which is a movie, right? And movies are wonderful things. They make a huge splash and stick around for a few months, but then they kind of vanish from the public consciousness. Game of Thrones was a phenomenon for 10 years. It's something that did not fade from the public consciousness while it was hot. And so people were hearing the languages a lot more. There was just a lot more content, you know, in terms of hours. But also it didn't have that time to kind of like fade away. I think that really made an impression, not just on audiences, but also on writers and producers and directors who weren't able to kind of like see, you know, a phenomenon and then forget about it. It was constantly reminding them that a created language was another potential tool for them as they tried to bring their show to life. And really, I think that was enough to kind of allow it to hit in many other places.
Language is a living, breathing thing. Have you ever gotten, I don't know, a response from an actor who's like, listen, man, I just can't say that. Like, that's just too weird. Or I can't learn this particular turn of phrase. Do you ever tailor your work in response?
Believe it or not, that's happened very rarely, very rarely. For the most part, actors are really excited about that because it gives them a tool to get into character, something that they don't have to invent on their own. It's like, here is this language that nobody's ever heard before, and this tells me that I am in this character. So most of the time, they react pretty well. Sometimes, like if an actor is struggling with a particular sound, it is very freeing to be able to say, well, I can just retranslate that and fix it so that that sound doesn't occur in that line. Sometimes if the word hasn't been used before, I can just change the word.
David J. Peterson is a language creator and author of the book, The Art of Language Invention. Thank you so much for being here.
Que rimbose.
Okay, what was that one?
That was Hibernian.
Dracarys.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. You can talk to us in any language, real or otherwise. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway.